Welcome to Books and Beyond with your host, Alison. Join us for half an hour of information, entertainment, reading recommendations, and beyond. Brought to you by Auckland Libraries.
I know this girl, and she works in a library.
Nau mai, haere mai, kia ora, and welcome to our Books and Beyond Literary Lounge with Alison and Inika. Kia ora, Inika.
Kia ora, Alison.
Well, as usual, today we're going to be talking about what we're reading, what we've been reading, and what's on our to-be-read lists.
Yeah.
So we've been both reading up a storm over the last couple of weeks.
We have, yes. Reading up a storm, one eye on the Olympics, one eye on the book.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Yep, so we're really excited to present some heavy hitters today.
Absolutely.
Hopefully some gold medal winners. Yeah. So look, let's start, I think we'll start with Unsheltered by Claire Mulleta.
Fantastic.
Yeah. So now this is a book that's just quite recently published, so May 2021. And Claire Mulleta is a Kiwi Aussie. So I don't know whether you'd call that a quasi or something. I think I might. Yeah. So, but both New Zealand and Australia, I'm sure both countries are going to want to claim her after this.
It often happens, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They'll be saying she's ours.
That's right.
She was born in New Zealand, raised in Western Australia, and now she's back living in Wellington.
Mm.
So now this book, Unsheltered, it's set in the near future in a place that's eerily like Australia, but, you know, it could be anywhere.
Mm.
And it's an engrossing novel. It describes a country that has disintegrated due to climate destruction and a sort of general system breakdown with a bit of pandemic thrown into the mix.
Mm.
So it sounds as though it could happen, doesn't it?
It's a bit scarily possible, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
A bit too close to the line sometimes.
Right. And so in the story, the society virtually has no governance, no structures. The systems that are still in place are cruel and heartless.
Mm.
And those people who are unsheltered are seeking asylum in the sheltered land, but they're treated just appallingly by this really brutal bureaucracy.
Mm.
So our main character, Lee, has become separated from her 8-year-old daughter, Matty, while attempting to navigate this chaos. And so Lee sets out on foot on this really harrowing journey. She's trying to find out what's happened to Matty and also trying to find her, basically.
Mm.
And we've got this countryside that's barren and unforgiving and dangerous. And Lee has to use all her skills and wits to survive. So, yeah, and this is a novel that asks us to consider what happens when everything we have is gone and when all we have left is our shared humanity.
Mm.
And then what happens when supplies of collective goodwill begin to disappear? And all of that sort of sounds, that could happen, or it's kind of happening already in societies, isn't it?
It does, yeah. I think that's a really good description, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm.
So it's a real wake-up call to the world. I believe she's saying, you know, you do nothing about the climate emergency we're facing at your peril.
Mm.
And if we do nothing to claw back our destructive practices, this is the reality that we face.
It's definitely a cautionary tale, this one, and she's not pulling any punches, is she?
No.
Yeah.
That's
which
right.
I think is actually right. It really is right now. We need
We
need that wake-up call.
We do, And, you know, it's a book, it's engrossing, it's absorbing, it's gripping, but quite moving as well.
Mm.
And it has a lot of tender moments. You know, and it's as we were saying before, it's possibly some of it's been done before. The mother's love for her child that will take her literally to the ends of the earth.
Yes, that's right. It's really interesting that mother-daughter relationship they have in the book. She's got this really deep love of her daughter, and that's pushing her on, of course, to try and find her. But there's also this discomfort in the relationship as well, because Lee, in her heart of hearts, she wonders whether she should have ever had a child with her partner Frank, who dies tragically near the beginning of the book. Whether she should have brought a child into this, you know, increasingly inhospitable world with this uncertain future. And I wondered whether she kind of built that, the interesting relationship that they have, you know, where the daughter is kind of closer to her dad than her mum. I wondered whether the mum sort of had this protective layer between herself and her child just because of the uncertainty of their circumstances. It was really interesting.
It was almost like she had an ambivalence, didn't she, about being a parent. But then once you're a parent, then you'd crawl over hot coals.
That's right. There's no going back, right?
But that does come through quite a bit.
Quite strongly, yeah.
It's an interesting one, isn't it? And it also, I think, gave me a sense of how if a government has a one-child policy, how that can force people into making heartbreaking decisions as well.
Yeah, it was interesting. They talked about having a replacement policy at one stage and then moving on to a one-child policy. That was very interesting to think about.
Yeah, and it's a bit frightening. And we've seen examples of that in the real world. You know, there's so much to think about as well. Like, something that really struck me was how difficult it is to deal with faceless bureaucracies. And even in our non-dystopian society or our real society, and it's something that you and I see probably all the time in libraries, that if you're digitally disadvantaged, trying to deal with a government bureaucracy, it's just bewildering, isn't it?
That's right, especially as everything moves online.
Yeah, that's right.
Which is kind of accelerated result of COVID.
Yeah. Absolutely. And so, of course, in the book, it's just exponentially worse for her, isn't it? And she'd have a small amount of credit on her phone to try and ring whatever the department was called to try and, you know, is there any news and that sort of thing. And you just got the sense of desperation.
Yeah, there wasn't really any human connection at all in the government, was there? It was all being run through internet and automated phone services.
Yes.
Yeah, again, really close to the bone.
That's right. You know, I was thinking that listeners might expect that this is going to be a really grim and depressing story, but there's quite a few moments of lightness throughout the book. And moments, of course, of tenderness and the kindness of strangers.
Yes.
And those moments were very moving. But we were saying before, there were those times of real classic Aussie deadpan humour, which they shone through when the part that I enjoyed, when Lee and Frank come across a deserted pub.
Yes.
And they kind of imagine themselves owning the pub and running it. And didn't they say we could take turns at being the customer?
Yeah, that was great. Yeah. I mean, even when there's no Fosters left, the Aussies are still wanting to have the bar and there's nothing coming out of the taps bar.
Yeah, just a few.
Living the dream.
Yeah, because it is every Australian's dream, really, isn't
it? Of course.
To own a pub. So there's, some humour in that as well, which lightens things up a bit. But I sort of think that this is a novel that's going to have real broad appeal to both a younger and an older audience.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it did remind me of quite a few, you know, dystopian books and you know, there's a lot in that climate fiction space now, isn't there?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, there was the, you know, The Road, Station 11. I even thought of the Tomorrow series by John Marsden, which is kind of like a World War III.
Yeah, there was that element in this book too, because there was conscription of,
a
ballot and conscription system for children aged 15 and over, wasn't there? And that was part of the mix for the children who had her child who's disappeared with a group of other children, hey?
Yes. Mm. Yeah, so it's a good one. I recommend that one.
Definitely. Well, I've also been reading, we've been reading quite a bit of New Zealand fiction, haven't we, Alison, preparing for nominations for the International Dublin Literary Award, and it's been an absolute pleasure to be doing that. So as part of that research, and for my own pleasure, I have been reading Sorrow and Bliss by Meg Mason. This was published in 2020 and it's available in all our formats. There is a bit of a queue in it, so I would just say get in the queue and get ready for it. This is the third novel from Meg Mason. She's a New Zealand author and journalist, but she's been based in Australia for many years, in Sydney, and then also in the UK for 5 years as well. This was released in February 2021. It's gone on to the summer bestseller charts in the UK and the US, and the rights to the TV series are already secured. So you do want to get in on this one because there's a lot of hype around it. Now, I think it's pretty deserved, actually. This was a really readable book. I really did inhale it. I say that a lot, but I really did. Now, our main character in this book is Martha, and she's lived with mental illness since she was around 17 years old. And at times, the periods of her her mental illness where it's affected her most have left her completely incapacitated and even on the verge of suicide. Now, she and her family have really become used to that endless rounds of doctors and different diagnoses and changes of medication that are so common for people who are struggling with their mental illnesses and mental health. It's been a real roller coaster ride. So she sometimes have these periods of being very, you know, relatively well, and then she just crashes and is at rock bottom for can be weeks or even months at a time. Now, she's mostly adored by her family, but she's not always liked or understood, and that is really a lot to do with how her illness manifests. She's very dependent on them and on her partner for emotional support and at times financial support as well. But she does feel quite resentful of this, even though she really does need them. And she does sometimes wonder if it would be better for everyone, herself included, if she maybe wasn't around anymore. So it's a tough situation, really tough. She's really bright. She's very quick-witted, but sometimes she's impetuous and cruel to others. She's very generous and sensitive, noticing other people's feelings, but sometimes she's really, really not. So, you know, it just flips. It flips. She's very honest, and sometimes it's brutal honesty, but quite difficult to trust. And she can be quite harsh on herself and then other times too soft. So, yeah, really quite an interesting character. Really interesting character. Very real. Very relatable. When we meet her, she's at a really low point. She's almost 40. Her job is pretty stagnant. Her devoted husband, who she thought would never leave, has left. And her best friend and sister, Ingrid, is no longer talking to her. And she's really the person that Martha's gone to all the time for help and support. Now, Martha receives a new diagnosis and treatment partway through the book, and she actually keeps this to herself as it's actually working, and she kind of keeps that close for one reason or another, which becomes clear in the book. She's actually quite afraid of where her illness and her true personality lie. She doesn't really know because she has been in this state of illness for so long and been on such a range of medications that she's just really not sure who she really is without that illness. Very interesting twist is that when she does get this final diagnosis, which we assume is correct, the author leaves the diagnosis empty. So as not to kind of overlay any pre-assumptions, I guess, about how that illness manifests or, how it's been portrayed. It really reminded me of Fleabag, and I know that's been on the promo material too, and I think that's really justified. It also reminded me of an author called Barbara Trepido, who was writing in the 80s and 90s mainly. It's got this sort of upper middle class English vibe. It's got the dysfunctional but eccentric and interesting family, lots of quick wit. Yeah, interesting one. Really enjoyed it.
It's I loved it too. I really did. Mm. So I'd say that's one we could certainly recommend as well, couldn't we?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think it's important to remember that it's from a white middle to upper middle class perspective on mental health, and but so it's just one person's experience, really.
Yeah.
Be interesting to compare that with another book, like maybe Queenie by Candace Cardy-Williams.
Yes.
Came to mind. Yeah.
Yes, and some of those other books where the main character doesn't have the same safety net.
That's right.
You know, to fall back on.
Well, Luster by Raven Leilani would be another interesting one to compare this with. If you're, you know, getting into a book club discussion, I think that'll be really rich ground. Yeah.
Be great. Well, look, talking about books that you can really have a good discussion about, I wanted to talk to you about another Kiwi Aussie writer, called Jacqueline Bublitz, and her book, and there's a great buzz around this, is Before You Knew My Name. So now Jacqueline Bublitz divides her time between Melbourne and her hometown of New Plymouth, and this is her debut novel, and it's set in the modern era in New York, and it's basically about violence and the patriarchy, but it's actually quite uplifting in a strange kind of way. It, I would say, it needs a mild trigger warning, if there's such a thing. I don't know if that makes any sense, but because it is about a murder, but even though it doesn't go into the graphic details of the murder, it's more focused on the before and the after, not the actual scene. But it's something to be aware of.
Sure.
So what I love about this book is that the writer subverts those cliches of crime fiction in really exhilarating kind of ways. It's a book about this fascination that we have in our society. It's fascination with dead girls.
Mm.
And I'm saying that with air quotes,
sure.
The dead girl. You know, all those books about murder that have girl in the title, you know, the girl on the train, the girl in the mirror, you know, the girl
in the window,
the girl doing all of those. And but what Jacqueline Bublitz does, she absolutely turns the dead girl trope on its head, and that's what I love about it. It's actually a very feminist novel, but having said that, it's going to have broad appeal. It will appeal to men, women, any, you know, however you identify.
Mm.
So basically the story goes that you've got these two young women, they're both recent arrivals in New York City, and they're both, they don't know each other, so they've come from opposite sides of the world, both fleeing from relationships with predatory men. They cross paths and their fates become entwined forever, basically. Mm-hmm. In another world, in a perfect world, they might have met on a park bench in Central Park, chatted and become friends and, you know, had a great friendship.
Mm.
But that doesn't happen in this book because one of them, when they meet, one of them is already dead. Sounds weird, doesn't it? But so you've got an 18-year-old woman called Alice, and she's steps off a cross-country bus that's brought her from small town Wisconsin to New York. She's got nothing but a bit of cash and a camera that she stole from her art teacher who had groomed her into having a, if you'd call it a relationship. I don't know if you really could, but she thought it was a relationship. A month later, she's dead. She's an unidentified Jane Doe, found murdered and raped in the river by Central Park.
Wow.
And at the same time, you've got a 36-year-old Ruby who's travelled from Australia to New York. She's recovering from a long-term relationship with a married man, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And she's there hoping to reset and recover, but her life is turned upside down when she discovers Alice's body while she's out jogging. This scene, you know, the pretty young woman who's found murdered in the park, this is the beginning of numerous novels, I would say, and then sort of hundreds of TV shows.
Right.
But in this
too
book,
many,
yeah,
in
too
opinion.
Many. Yeah. Yeah. And that's our weird fascination that we've
that's
got.
That's right.
But in this book, it happens about a third of the way through the book. So we've already learned a lot about our characters. And it's a catalyst for a different kind of story where all those cliches and tropes about dead women are pulled apart. Ruby becomes very obsessed with identifying the Jane Doe and solving her murder. Who was Alice? Why did she die? Mm. What might she have done with her precious life if this hadn't have happened? So, that victim narrative's really undercut, and because the narrator of the book is the dead girl.
I see.
So, so after her death, Alice goes on narrating the world around her. It's really, really interesting. And it's not so much a who did this, who was he, you know, mm-hmm. what was it about him that we want to know. It was how does this happen?
Yeah.
You know, and it's just a different way of looking at the murder of women
very
that we
smart.
See. Yeah.
Yeah.
And what is wrong with the world that these crimes occur? And why are we so obsessed with the narratives around them? It's a really, really smart book.
Mm.
It's compelling. It's really readable. Reminded me quite a bit of Alice Sebold's The Lovely Bones, but I found
yes.
it a bit more uplifting.
Yeah, because then that the murder victim was a child, wasn't it?
Yes, I found
that
really hard.
It was creepy, that one.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, it was compelling, but also very creepy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. I'm really looking forward to reading that.
Yeah, highly recommend it. It's a good one.
You know me, I'm not big on crime, but I do like a... I'm interested in the... Yeah, I think this is actually right up my alley.
I think it might be.
Yeah.
The way a whole bunch of stuff gets turned on its head.
I think so.
You like that analysis.
Yeah.
That comes with it.
Well, having said that I'm not really into crime, I did actually read a crime novel last week on my
really?
Break. Yes, I did.
Yeah. What came
Check
over
Check me
you?
Out. I know. So I read The Maidens by Alex Michaelides, published last year and found in Adult Fiction and the Crime. Not on e-books yet, but I'm sure it will be. Now, Alex Michaelides, he had his debut novel was out in 2019. It was called The Silent Patient, and it was a big bestseller. So this one is his follow-up and hotly anticipated. In this book, we have our main character is a group counsellor called Mariana. Now, she's half Greek and half English. When you meet her, she's grieving for her husband who died a year before. He drowned while they were on holiday in Naxos in her old hometown. Now, she's an expert in leading group therapy, and she was always listening for what's said and unsaid from her clients. But she herself is really caught up in a cycle of grief, you know, in the memories of the past that she has with her husband, and really in mourning for the future that she can't have with him anymore. Now, she gets a call from her niece, Zoe, who's a student at Cambridge University. And Zoe's roommate and best friend, Tara, has been murdered. So Mariana heads off to Cambridge University to support her niece, who's also like a foster daughter because Zoe's parents died in a tragic accident earlier, so she's quite close to her niece. And she ends up enmeshed in the case, both on a personal and professional level, because she's asked to kind of support students in processing the murder and the fear that's surrounding the campus. But also she's being asked to kind of get them talking so that they can try and uncover more clues about who the killer might be. Now, she starts her own investigation separate from the official one, and she's focused very quickly on in the piece on the charismatic Professor Edward Fosca, who's an expert in Greek mythology and particularly in Greek tragedies. Now, the murder victim was a member of a select group of students that he led called the Maidens. Now, all of the Maidens are female, beautiful and brilliant, and they're actually also his only alibis for the night of the murder.
Mm.
And Tara, the murder victim, was one of these maidens.
Mm.
So Mariana's Greek heritage comes into play here because she's got this insider knowledge that helps her to make connections between the murders and Greek myths, particularly those surrounding Persephone and Hades, so death and the maiden, and also looking at the sort of secret rituals that were performed during the Eleusinian Mysteries, which if you're a former classic student, you might know about. If you're not, don't worry. She goes into it in a good amount of detail, so you get a good understanding of this sort of like cult of the death and the maiden. Now, she's following the clues, but while she's doing that, she's been pursued by various men with various and nefarious intentions. She's got an unstable patient who's a bit of a stalker. There's a young Cambridge student who falls in love with her on the train ride up from London and who keeps following her around. And Professor Fosker as well is kind of deep in the mix and sort of starting to kind of stay on her trail. Lots of atmosphere in this one, lots of dark, shadowy staircases and punting down the river at midnight, lots of places for lurkers. Short read, super quick, short chapters. It was a bit lurid. And the writing was, you know, it's fit for purpose. It wasn't fancy. If you're thinking like Donatarte's Secret History, less of that, more kind of a Dan Brown kind of problem-solving sort of vibe.
I get where you're coming from.
Yeah. Get in the queue. The reveal of the whodunit is a good guess. Like, I mean, I pretty much worked it out at some point, but, you know, it was still a good read. You could try some other books while you wait as well. So you could try The Secret History by Donatarte, or you could give The Truants by Kate Weinberg or The Bellwether Revivals by Benjamin Wood a go as well. All those vibes of academia and murder. Yeah.
That sounds really... I think I wouldn't mind trying that, actually.
Yeah, give it
and
a go.
I kind of had a feeling I might know who did it, just, but I bet I'm wrong.
You're probably right. You're pretty big on the crime. You're probably like, I can see this a mile off.
Yeah, I should try it and then see if I'm right, but I probably won't be. Hey, I've got time for a bit of a TBR here. This weekend, I'm planning to kind of start something completely different, and I'm going to start it's a road novel. I do like these road trips, and it's called The Last Great Road Bum by Hector Tobar. I don't think I've pronounced that his name properly, so I do apologise for that. So this is a novel that's based on a true story, and it's about a fella from Illinois in the Midwest of America called Joe Sanderson. And he was a man who died in pursuit of a life that was worth writing about. He was, in his own words, a road bum. He was an adventurer, storyteller, one of those people that
Rolling Stone?
Rolling Stone, that's the word.
Rolling Stone.
Yes, thank you for that. I knew you'd have a good music thing there. But anyway, so he basically born in Illinois, died fighting with the guerrillas in Central America.
Oh, wow.
And so basically we know the beginning and the end. So with these facts, this great novelist, Hector Tobar, set out to write what would become a great road novel called The Last Great Road Bum.
Wow.
So,
Is this a recent one? Or?
Yes. It's just been published in the last year.
Oh, nice.
But it looks really, really interesting, and it's nicely presented. It's got a really cool map with a motorcycle on it.
Awesome.
It just sort of grabbed me. So I'm looking forward to that.
I like a road trip movie too. And movie, book, anything really.
Yes.
Yeah.
This would probably make quite a good film, I would say.
I'll just clarify. Now, the guerrillas in Central America, we are talking...
Oh, yes. The guerrillas.
Yeah.
Yes.
Guerrillas.
Yes. Yeah, cool. Yes. I know. Not the ones in the mist. Yeah. Although there might have been a bit of... miss, but they're definitely gorillas. Yes. So, so that's going to be
awesome.
A good one.
Well, I've still got a stack a mile high left over from my holiday picks, so I will talk to you about my to be read once I have got a few more under my belt. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I'll look forward to hearing about that, because I know you did heaps of reading last week, didn't you? So
I did, well, yeah. Done. So lots to talk about next week too.
Yeah. Oh, look, that'll be great. Well, look, to our listeners, thanks so much today for tuning in. This has been really, really fun. We've enjoyed the New Zealand books, and all kind of Australian as well books today. So, look, thanks once again. Take care and be kind to yourselves. Happy reading. Haere rā, ka kite anō.
program was brought to you by Auckland Libraries. Find us online at aucklandlibraries.govt.nz and catch the program next Sunday at 9:35 p.m. on 104.6 FM or anytime online at planetaudio.org.nz/booksandbeyond. Every day, every day.